Welcome you all to this session of SATPA, Truth and Scientific Inquiry. We are very lucky to have Professor Bryson Brown here to elucidate the subject for us. After all, it's a subject which is sort of at the basis of society, and most of us know very little about this scientific process. So we thought what might be rather interesting to learn more about it from a philosopher. You say, well, why didn't you not invite a scientist? Well, very often it is best to have someone look into the house rather than live in the house, you know, and visitors come to your home and they know what's wrong in that place in which you don't identify yourself, you know, so that's why we asked Bryson Brown to do this for us. But before I let him get rolling, I must, in the interest of scientific process, inform you as to who he is, so that the information he gives you, you can judge to be credible. So I will go into a little bit of detail on this, just because it's part of the scientific session. Bryson, I will refer to you as Bryson, if that is okay. But he did become a professor, and you have to earn that. And he has been at academic locations for the last 25 years, which include Pittsburgh, Houston, Halifax, Melbourne, and Lethbridge. And we are very lucky to have him here at the Department of Philosophy at the university. He did his PhD in 1985 in Pittsburgh, and dissertation is called Science in Conflict. When I say dissertation, I mean that's a book about that thick that has to be written. He also wrote a master thesis, and he's got a BA from Trent University. He received something like 14 awards, grants, and prizes from various institutions and so on. Administrative responsibilities include 38 in total numbers in the past over his professional life. That is president of this, a member of this, and assistant of this, and so on. So these people are not just staring out the window. Research interests include history of philosophy of science, philosophical logic, and power consistent logic. Publications include 4 books, contributions to, and the latest one is Truth and Probability. He has written some 30 articles in reviewed scientific literature. Now, that's very, very important. That doesn't include the Inquiry or anything like this. We are talking about journals. If you submit something, these things are reviewed by experts, and if it's rubbish, well, you know, try again. So he did that for 30 successful articles. Including reviews, which are sort of special objective, and there's 7 of those. And he has presented papers at academic institutions and at 17 locations. These are invited lectures and so on. Now, this one would not be included because it's not high enough profile. His professional and editorial service, he's president-elect of the Society of Exact Philosophy, and he belongs to the Canadian Philosophy Society, and on, it just goes on. So this gives you some hint as to what a person like that has to go through before he becomes a professor. And this gives you the background, and I'm sorry that I was rather lengthy, is to give you the ability to assess how credible it is what he's going to say to us. In the next 25 minutes, poor Bryson, is going to review this huge subject in 25 minutes, so better pay attention. Bryson, please.
Thanks very much, Klaus. I'll just take you very briefly through this script, and I hope I don't have too many slides.
Okay, sir, you have to
talk into the mic. Okay. Well, I'll take you very briefly through this comic strip that I wanted to start the show with, and unfortunately I can't make it big enough for you to read the text. This is a young man studying, apparently, and his first remark is, "Fudge," as he stares at his calculator, "that can't be right." And then he says, "time to get a new calculator," and he throws it in the bin. And then another figure intrudes on the scene. This is Situational Science Man. And The kid, let me see, I'm going to have to go and look at it because it's a while since I read it.
Okay.
There's those touchpads are twitching.
What we get next is, you know, these pesky scientific facts won't align with my beliefs. And situational science man says, situational science man says, then challenge them, Steve. Challenge these scientific facts. And we get a little bit of an interaction that finishes with the following remarks from situational science man. He says, that's why I, speaking of science, always teach the controversy. The evolutionary controversy, the global warming controversy, the tobacco controversy, the mercury controversy, the so on and so forth, a long list of controversies, supposedly, about what science has to tell us when we really don't want to hear it. And Stevie gets it. Stevie declares, oh, I see, Mr. Situational Science Man. You're right. I'll never trust science again. It's too controversial. And Situational Science Man says, Stevie gets it, folks. Do you?
That's enough for half the meeting.
So there's a small quote here from Douglas Adams. I'll take the awe of understanding over the awe of ignorance anytime. The question starts, we start with the question, why should we pay attention to science? Which is really the issue that's raised in that cartoon. Why should we pay any more attention, any more respect to what science has to tell us about the world than any other source of information, any other authority that you might want to refer to? The authority of science today, as I put there, is emphasized by the fact that rather than reject science outright, skeptics today aim to appropriate or undermine its authority. So biblical literalists, for instance, claim under the heading of creation science, not that we should ignore science, but that when we do science right, what we get is some version of the book of Genesis. And similarly, global warming skeptics have reached for the label junk science to dismiss as not really credible the scientific work that climatologists have done in support of the hypothesis that we are now contributing to substantial changes in the world's climate. Now, in the public eye, this is very difficult to respond to. It's easy to make it look as though there's a real debate in the public press. All you need to do is have an opinion columnist who will say, well, global warming is bunk. All you need to do is have sources of funding for publications of various kinds. And if industry is interested in an issue, well, it's not too hard to get some funding to publish various kinds of views and to disseminate those views. And very few people are going to notice when you do this that the controversy is only there in the public media, that it really doesn't have any standing in the scientific journals, that there isn't really a debate, or if there's a debate, it's a very different debate in the scientific journals. And when you point this out, even then, the skeptics have an answer. Situational science man has an answer. All he has to say is, well, the scientific journals themselves are biased and dishonest. We shouldn't trust the scientific process. They're refusing to publish any work that's contradictory to their orthodox views. That is to say, you equate science to a kind of rigid belief system that is locked in and unwilling to pay attention to the evidence. Now, there are real dangers that this kind of behavior and this kind of problem poses. If we start to judge science and scientific questions on the basis of unreliable and biased sources, then exploiting people's ignorance becomes very easy. Once you've decided and once you've persuaded them that they shouldn't trust scientific sources in particular or other good sources of information, judges, for instance, about legal questions, once you've persuaded them they shouldn't trust those sources, then you can tell them anything you want. And if it's the sort of thing they want to believe, well, then that'll go over just fine. Beliefs matter, though. If our beliefs are open to this kind of manipulation, we're vulnerable. if public policy issues really turn on facts rather than babble-gab or spin or so on and so forth, if public policy issues really matter to us and they turn on important facts, then we really do need to find ways of identifying reliable sources of information about those facts. Now, there are two kinds of skepticism that I want to distinguish carefully here, because it's often said that scientists should be skeptics, and I think it's true that scientists should be skeptics. But there's a difference between what I call idle skepticism and what I'm prepared to call scientific skepticism. The idle skeptic is someone who simply poo-poos the evidence. You say, oh, well, that doesn't prove it. And if someone has another argument, you say, well, that doesn't prove it. And because, well, I question your premises, or maybe I question the connection between your premises or your evidence and the conclusions you're reaching. And you can say in response, but here's an explanation of that connection. Here's some more evidence backing up my evidence. And they can just come right back at you again. It's like a three-year-old asking why and why and why. It never ends. You can't cut them off. And the idle skeptic is content to play that game. That's the end of the story as far as they're concerned. They don't have to accept anything they don't want to accept because they can exhaust you. If they're willing to go on asking, you know, where's your evidence for this? Where's your evidence for that? Why should I trust that authority? Why should I trust, for instance, what Darwin and Wallace said about the distribution of life across space and time? Well, you know, that's a long story that I have to give in reply to that question. If you've decided that you don't want to trust any of those sources, we're going to spend a long time before we could ever resolve the issue. And if you insist on playing the idle skeptic, I'll never persuade you. I can't. A scientific skeptic is something different. A scientific skeptic does believe that the right sort of evidence and the right sort of arguments can settle a question, can give us really good reasons to believe something. Say that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. But that's an open question at the same time for the scientific skeptic. What does this evidence show? Is there any basis for questioning it? Those are questions that can be asked and can be pursued. So the scientific skeptic is open to seeing our minds change about these issues, but she's also prepared to draw a conclusion when the evidence is good enough and makes sense. It's well presented, well argued. Idle skeptics often present the issue as one of choosing between alternative systems of belief, and a system of belief is thought of as a kind of a closed thing. It comes with its own authorities, it comes with its own sources of evidence, and they're just incomparable. You just have to choose, say, between creation and evolution. And because of this picture that they have of the situation, they often deny that there could be any basis for resolving the debate in favor of one side or the other. So you have your point of view and we have ours, and there's no kind of evidence that could judge between them. So we can say on their view, the situation between the two sides in a debate like this are symmetrical. Or is symmetrical, I should say. It's one situation. Now, how are we going to go about choosing sides here? Let's talk about the creationist question. Some people tell you that the geological column is a circular invention used by atheist scientists to create the illusion that evolution is true. Others tell you that these people are either ignorant about the facts or distorting them. So who should you trust? If it comes down to a question of trust, it seems perfectly symmetrical. You know, I'm fond of this person and I don't know that guy very well, or, you know, I feel feelings of trust towards this person and not that person. If that's how we make this choice, we don't really have much in the way of reasons for really making the choice. And so there's a question here. How do we put ourselves in a position to make this call? I think most of us here would not be in a position to make the call on that challenge and response. I mean, how many here know anything about the history of geology and how the geological column actually developed historically? Okay, not a topic you've done. Okay, fair enough. So we're not in a position to make the call ourselves. And we shouldn't do it just on the basis of who do you trust, right? There are plenty of hucksters out there who are pretty good at saying that in a way that draws you in. I think I was doing Jack Nicholson there. So the challenge is a difficult one, but it's well worth some effort here. As I said, our beliefs matter, and the conclusions that we draw about what's going on in the world matter. What scientists have learned about evolution in particular plays a critical role in our understanding of life. And it contributes to medicine, it contributes to our understanding of ecologies and how they interact and what's likely to happen to them. And more generally, as science progresses and our civilization goes on growing, we're going to face more and more questions, more and more issues in public policy that depend on input from science for the information that we need to make a reasonable choice. For instance, going forward, should we invest heavily in nuclear power, as some people, including Lovelock, have proposed as a response or part of our response to global warming? Well, that's very much a scientific and technical question. It's also a political question and an economic one. And it's going to take a lot of facts on the table before we can make a reasonable choice about a decision like that. To deal with such issues successfully, these issues that turn on scientific information and technical information, we need to sort out between what's settled fact, what we can really rely on, at least for now, what's uncertain but pretty likely, what's really still just unknown, and how this information relates to the policy options that we have. We need sources of real information, real reliable information that we can count on for identifying these categories of propositions and distinguishing them accurately. And we need to understand the sources of this information well enough to tell the difference between serious criticism and axe grinding. So we can ask ourselves, why has science come to have this high status, so that even people who are skeptical and want to reject scientific conclusions in many cases either try to claim that these conclusions aren't really based in science but only in some kind of junk science, or they actually try to claim that proper scientific investigation reveals all kinds of evidence for their own preferred view rather than the standard scientific point of view. By its own standards, science has been very successful. And I want to say these standards are standards that matter to us in a common sense sort of way. Coherence, and I'll say some more later about what that is. Predictive power, explanatory scope, reliability and reproducibility fit with observations. In terms of all of these questions, science has been extremely successful. The scientific worldview that we now have is rich and complex and very powerful. It's allowed us to build and invent all kinds of things and demonstrate all kinds of effects that we never would have dreamed of without the guidance of scientific theories and scientific investigation. It has also become an increasingly strange point of view on the world from the perspective of everyday common sense. We've explored the universe on a lot of different scales. We've looked at the very small scale, the scale of atoms and the scale of the particles that make atoms up. We've looked at the universe on the extremely large scale, on the scale of the whole universe, cosmos, right back to the microwave background radiation, and if we're lucky with gravitational wave observations, we may even be able to detect some of the processes that went on before the microwave background radiation emerged about 300,000 years after the black hole. After the Big Bang. Let's get that straight. As we study these extreme scales, the story we end up telling about the universe looks less and less like the familiar middle-sized world of chairs and tables and ordinary objects. Science, since roughly the 17th century, has been walking a very different path in terms of the kinds of descriptions it admits of situations and objects and so on, a much more austere and abstract and mathematically oriented path. Of course, this is particularly true of physics, but it's also true in the other sciences. There is a kind of science that's extremely persuasive and convincing right up front. And I've decided, because of an article I saw in the New York Times recently, to call it Mythbusters science. Some of you may know that show. Mythbusters science involves hands-on, common-sense examination of simple hypotheses. We set up the situation and we see what happens. A lot of real science actually looks like this. Clinical studies in medicine often take that form. What could be more commonsensical if you want to know whether a new treatment is good for people than to give, on the one hand, some people that treatment, and on the other hand, some people a placebo that's very difficult to tell from that treatment, and maybe you double-blind it so you don't even know as you're giving them the treatment which is which, and then observing how the two groups do. If the people getting the actual medication do substantially better than the people getting the placebo, that's a pretty good indication that the medicine is doing them some good. And that's just pure common sense. That's Mythbuster science. Theoretical science is another kettle of fish, but I want to say that it grows out of this kind of Mythbusters science. So what do we do when we can't just set up the situation? Looking at what happens when we set up various situations lays the foundation for much more complex and more powerful science. What we do is we establish certain principles. We observe certain regularities and patterns at the myth-busting level. And then we integrate those into mathematical or inferential structures, structures which we can reason with. And mathematics is essentially a very powerful reasoning tool. The result is that we have a theory at the end of the day. We've extended these simple regularities and things that we've noticed. Galileo noticing that, you know, when he set a ball rolling, it tended to come down an inclined plane and go all the way back up, almost to the height that he'd set it at on the other side. And he said, well, what's going on here? It's not like it's tending to stop. It's like, you know, maybe there's some interference along the way, some material factors that mean it doesn't come quite to the exact same level that it got to on the other side, but you roll it down and it rolls almost up to the top, and you know already that there are little things in the way and a little bit of loss of energy or motion along the way that's just because there's slight obstacles and resistances. You say, well, maybe the natural thing is for it to just keep on moving. If I took that arm off where it goes up and I'm stopping it and just let it roll, it would eventually stop, I know, but maybe it's just those little resistances that interfere with motion that stop it. So he comes up with a principle of inertia. It's not clear whether he thought it was circular motion or linear motion, but this is the sort of origin of the principle of inertia as a fundamental principle for motion. Nobody really thought that way before, that it was just natural for things to keep moving. So we establish these principles, and then we unite them into theories, as Newton did, with a number of other principles involving force and acceleration. Newton integrated this into a theory and added a law of gravity, and suddenly we had an understanding of what was going on in the solar system that explained not just the motions of the planets according to Kepler's rules, but the motions of comets, which had been much in the news at the time in the 1680s. And these systems of principles, which are connected and mathematicized and powerfully unified in an inferential way, they're much more powerful than just a bunch of simple regularities. Because we can produce models now. We can produce theoretical models of what's going on in the world. They guide us in producing and measuring new phenomena that aren't part of the common sense world. Things that we would never have found without the guidance of scientific theories that grew out of these simple principles united into powerful inferential structures. Radio waves, lasers, particle accelerators and detectors, solid-state electronics. Nobody would have guessed at any of this without having a very good grounding in scientific theory first. That's a reason to take history very seriously. Sorry, to take the history of science and theoretical science very seriously. Historical science is also, of course, often under attack from creationists. In fact, more than physics is. But it's very similar in its structure and its origins to the story that I've just told about theoretical science. We can observe processes in a Mythbuster sort of way. We can observe sedimentation and erosion happening right now. We can observe animal bodies and plant bodies after they've died and what happens to them. Mostly they disappear. But sometimes if they get buried in the right circumstances, parts of them, at any rate, especially hard parts, get preserved. We can observe these kinds of processes in a very common sense level. And out of this comes basic, simple principles that form the early basis for geological science and for paleontology. Steno, Nicholas Steno, 16th century, developed principles of sedimentation and into 17th. And his conclusion, he drew the conclusion that fossils really are, he's one of the first people to argue systematically for this, that fossils really are the remains of once living things. There were lots of other theories of what a fossil was, but Steno argued quite articulately for the idea that it's remains of living things. The geological column and, for instance, plate tectonic geology are much more theoretical entities. But they're built out of these simple principles and the application of these principles and the discovery of new evidence that these principles have revealed to us and the integration of that evidence into these kinds of rich inferential structures. So here's a common fallacy in the neighborhood. Creationists often insist that only statements from witnesses count as real evidence about the past. Well, that's just not common sense. That's not common sense at all. Witnesses are far less reliable than physical evidence in most cases. There might be some cases where a bit of physical evidence would mislead you and the witness was right, but as a general proposition, I'd much prefer to have physical evidence, whether I'm in a court of law or writing a scientific paper or a piece of history. In particular, common sense criteria make physical evidence far more credible than the rough and often inconsistent myths handed down from ancient days. Okay, we'll try to move along here. Again, we're reviewing some of the scientific criteria. These are mentioned by Michael Roos in some recent work. And they're it's a very standard list. External consistency, which is consistency with other things we believe. Fertility, how a theory contributes to further investigation and leads to further results. Internal coherence, that's how unified it is in inferential terms. Predictive accuracy, simplicity, kind of nice. Unifying power, does it tie together evidence of different kinds that different fields of study have worked up? Those are all good things. And we get these criteria not because we made up a game called science and decided to play with these criteria. We get these criteria because we actually have a general common sense notion of what's persuasive and convincing. Consistency is just an absence of conflict between our beliefs. You know, if I can infer the contrary of one belief from another belief I have, then I've got a problem. And I want to fix it. And that's just what consistency is. You fix that problem when you've got a consistent set of beliefs. Coherence, that requires inferential links connecting your beliefs. So it's related to unifying power as well. It's got to do with the fact that you're able to put things together. Predictive accuracy is obviously needed, because if you didn't have predictive accuracy, either you're not making any predictions and you don't have fertility, or you're making predictions and they're turning out wrong, in which case you've lost consistency and perhaps coherence as well. Fertility matters because we need something we can actually guide further investigation with. Unifying power is more of what goes into coherence, and simplicity, I put this aside as a small issue, is at least a convenience. So what is truth? Pilate's question is not easy to answer. And I'm going to skip a few slides because we're going to run out of time. There's an old philosophical puzzle that arises about how we judge between truth and falsity. On the one hand, we don't do it arbitrarily, so we must have some criteria we use. But how do we tell that those are good criteria? If you say it's because it tells us that the true things are true and the false things are false, then you're back to assuming the division you initially made between the true and the false. On the other hand, if you say there's some criteria for good criteria that my criteria for truth meet, then somebody can say, how do you know those are good criteria for criteria? And you're off on a regress. So if you think at the outset that it's just an open question what the connection between truth on the one hand and the evidence and the ways we judge evidence on the other hand, if you think it's just open whether there's a connection there or not, then we're really actually in quite a big problem. This goes back to the Greeks, actually, the recognition of the skeptical threat of circular regress no matter where you turn. I'm just going to... Diagnosis. This is inevitable, given how the puzzle's set up. The puzzle treats truth as a property of sentences, but assumes we don't know anything more than that about truth. And that means that every claim we make about what's true or how we know what's true is completely open to question. We've confused ourselves here. That is to say, we've entertained the idea that truth might be entirely separate and independent of the things that we use to decide what's true and what's false. And if it were true, then if that were true, truth would be a total mystery. We'd have no idea how to start with any investigation of anything. But truth, this is a mistake. Truth and evidence are inextricably tied together. They're not connected accidentally, they're connected essentially. Truth has to be what the evidence and good reasoning lead us to believe. That's not to say that they can't mislead us, but only that in the ideal sense, when we do it right, when we gather the relevant evidence and we reason with it correctly, we should arrive at the truth. And the methods that science uses here are the product of centuries of inquiry aimed at understanding the evidence we find around us and identifying the methods that fit together into a coherent whole. Stuff about institutions, Enlightenment institutions, are good for us, and science is one of them. Science originates roughly in the 17th century as an institution, journals and associations and so on of people trying to work out how the world works. So I wanted to finish with practical tips for self-defense, and then this is another Adams quote. It's a tough universe out there. People try to kill you, do you, anything. In a universe like that, you've really got to know where your towel is. So I'm hoping to give you at least some guess at where to put your hands on a towel. How do we tell who's off base when we're seeing these debates about global warming, about climate change, about evolution, about the threat that tobacco may pose to our health, and I'm sure it does pose to our health? First of all, if you want to look at these debates without investing your life and getting a scientific degree and accumulating the record that Klaus started with for me in very flattering terms, if you want to do it without going that way, the best thing you can do is to use a few clues. And the first clue is you learn some basic, easily recognized errors that are typically made. So if somebody says the evolutionary sequence of fossil types is used to order the Earth's strata, and the order of the strata is then applied to defend the evolutionary sequence, that's creationist propaganda. That's absolutely false. All you have to do is look at the history. And the history is a history of people who, by the way, weren't evolutionists who came up with the geological column. This is not some evolutionary, fraud. It's the product of a lot of careful scientific investigation. Similarly for these other remarks, there are basic remarks. If somebody says, just to get to climate theory for one moment before we go on, climate models ignore water vapor, which is much more important than greenhouse gas and CO2. Again, that's denialism that you're hearing. Water vapor comes in, but it's not as a forcing. I won't go to the details on that. Second, dig a little deeper on one or two questions. You can't figure everything out, but it doesn't take long to follow through a little bit. As you follow along, you'll often find one side provides more detail, information, and explanation, and the other side sticks to talking points. Well, that's when you know you're dealing with politicians and not serious people. C, look for quote mining. A quick look at some of the quotations deployed by creationists is very revealing, and I won't go into this, but they borrow quotations from all kinds of evolutionary figures. Stephen Jay Gould's been victimized this way. Darwin's been regularly victimized this way. And the quotes are out of context, distorted, excisions are made. It's terrible stuff. And you can check out their websites where you can find people who've bothered to track that down. D, consult your own common sense, but be modest about it. Don't try to apply your common sense to quantum mechanics. There's nothing commonsensical about quantum mechanics. And it won't lead you to sensible answers or sensible views of what's going on. It's hard enough with relativity. Relativity, in a sense, is common sense, but boy, it's deep common sense. Quantum mechanics is another package of another kettle of fish or whatever comparator you want. Instead, ask yourself about the motives and the institutional structures that these people are coming from. Scientists can ruin their reputation by going off half-cocked, by making claims that aren't justified by the evidence, by distorting their data and how they use their data. It's a quick ticket to an end of career. Whereas people representing other sorts of interests are often evaluated on the basis of how successful they are. If you're hiring an advertiser, you don't care whether he's telling the truth, really. You care about whether you're making sales. On the side, you know, you better not tell too many lies because there might be legal problems entailed. But that's the extent of your worry about the truth. Okay. And I'll just close with that.
Thank you, Bryson, for attempting the impossible in such a coherent way. Thank you very much. Well, let's have lunch, ladies and gentlemen. I just remind you, of course, to make your donation to the cause of $8. And remind you that next week's talk will be on killing the golden goose in our headwaters, which is all about the quality and quantity of water coming down the mountains to feed us. So that's what that subject is all about. All right, we come back together maybe about 5 minutes to one, because Bryson has to give a lecture at 1:40, so and he gave one this morning and he gave this one, so he's a busy boy today. Okay, thank you very much.